Hello, this is Mark Peacock, and welcome to the Travel Commons Podcast. This is Travel Commons Podcast number 70, recorded Tuesday, December 23rd, 2008. This is the podcast giving the voice of the traveler. It's more about the journey than the destination. There's three topics on this edition of the Travel Commons Podcast: packing a suit, can a video conference replace travel yet, and outsmarting winter flight delays. Well, this week, coming to you today from the Travel Commons studios outside of Chicago, Illinois, I'm done for travel this year. I got into O'Hare about 4:30 p.m. last Friday, and I am not getting on another plane until January 6th. Of course, two travel-free weeks don't come for free, so I've had to do a good bit of travel between Thanksgiving and last Friday. I'll tell you, 2 weeks ago, though, I ended up in one of, the craziest, stupidest travel itineraries I've had in a long, long time. I left Chicago Sunday night, 4 p.m. for London, getting into Heathrow about 6 a.m., which, of course, is midnight Chicago time. I caught a car to a 10 a.m. client meeting in Woking, which is somewhere around Guildford, for those of you who know London. Had lunch, then caught a cab back to Heathrow for a 4:20 p.m. flight back to the U.S. I landed in Washington, D.C. at Dulles Airport around 8 p.m. Eastern Time, connecting to a 10 p.m. flight to Denver. I touched down in Denver in the middle of a raging snowstorm at midnight mountain time. We end up taxiing past five snowplows, sort of in wing formation, waiting for us to get out of the way so they can try and stay ahead of the snow. I eventually get my rental car and drive 40 miles to my hotel. Well, no surprise there. I mean, look, you got to drive 10 miles just to get off the airport property at DIA. And finally get into my hotel room at 1:30 a.m. Mountain Time. So if I do the math right, if I'm doing all the conversions right, my Monday, which started at 6 a.m. London time and ended at 1:30 a.m. Denver time, lasted over 26 hours. And then the guys I was meeting with in Denver wanted to meet at 7:15 a.m. to get an early start, they said. I'll tell you, a long day and a short night made for some slow motion the next day. Following up, a couple of additional comments on the travel roulette stories from episode 67 and 68. Ian Morgan writes, "You know, my worst experience, a recent trip to Hong Kong, this time on holiday, not on business. The day before we were due to leave on a Qantas flight to Sydney, there was a huge typhoon warning with wind speeds expected to be about 140 miles an hour. Of course, the airport shut down and my original flight was canceled. I was offered two choices. One was to depart the following afternoon on my original flight that had been rescheduled in business class, or my other option to transfer to the 6 a.m. flight in first class, which had been our ticketed cabin. Qantas told me the plane was already on the ground in Hong Kong with the crew for the 6 a.m. and just in case of the airport reopening overnight, we'd be on our way. So we arrive at the Qantas check-in desk at 4 a.m. to find that the flight was delayed to 9 a.m. Qantas had redeployed the plane that they had told us was on the ground onto some London service. And also, we've been downgraded from first all the way down to economy. And now the other p.m. flight, my other alternative, well, that flight was now full in all the classes. So to cut a long story short, the inbound A330 didn't even arrive until 1 p.m. And by the time we took off, it was 3 p.m. Then we get an announcement that because of a high headwind, we weren't going to make Sydney before the airport closes at 11 p.m. We were showing an 11:01 p.m. Estimated time of arrival, and the airport had refused to extend the curfew by 1 minute, so we were going to Brisbane. So we landed at Brisbane at 11:10 to find that there was no way we could get a hotel, so we ended up sleeping in the airport overnight before catching a Qantas flight the next morning to Sydney. Okay, so we're finally on our way, until someone had what they thought was a heart attack. We end up returning to Brisbane, and of course, the crew timed out. So to cut the story short again, we didn't get to Sydney until about 6 p.m. that afternoon, that is more than 24 hours after leaving Hong Kong. And the worst part was knowing that my rescheduled flight from Hong Kong had departed Hong Kong before we had and got to Sydney safely the night before. Marathon, long story. Again, long story short, I can honestly say that I will never try to beat the system and sneak onto an earlier flight again in those circumstances. Well, Ian, that one hurts. I'll tell you, I've had a few flights where I made the wrong decision, but never where it ended up costing me a lost day. Linda Martin of the Indie Travel Podcast thinks that travel roulette demonstrates the psychological principle that choices make us healthier. Linda says, I studied psych at university, and I remember one study conducted on rats. Now, this is Mark talking, rats, travelers, frequent travelers. Is there a connection? Anyhow, let's go on back to Linda's story. They rigged up a double cage with one rat in each part, then gave each rat a slight electric shock. One rat had the power to stop the current by pressing a switch, but the other rat had no choice but to wait until its partner rat decided to press the switch. The psychologists recorded the incidence of cancer in all the rats in the study and found that the rats who did not have a choice were far more likely to get sick than those who had the choice, even though the rat on the other side of the cage was shocked for exactly the same length of time. You know, it sounds like hunting for better flights, according to Linda, puts you in a similar situation to these rats. You have the choice to change flights, and I think that will make you less stressed than someone who can't change and has to stay on their plane no matter what. So maybe you're keeping yourself healthy by playing roulette, and you win whether the flight you choose gets in first or not. Well, there you go, Ian. You may have lost a day, but according to Linda, the opportunity to lose that day will make you healthier in the long run. On a separate topic, Peter Rukavina writes, by coincidence, as I was listening to Travel Commons number 69 and your suggestion that we should not give up on frequent flyer programs just yet, I just booked a Charlottetown, Canada to Boston trip on Air Canada using miles from their Aeroplan program. This is remarkable, mostly because I did this only 4 days in advance of travel on the weekend of the American Thanksgiving. Peter nicely separating that or distinguishing that from the Canadian Thanksgiving. Back to Peter's comment. And at the base 15,000-mile level. My own experience of Aeroplan is littered with episodes of being offered convenient routings that involve two overnight layovers and require hundreds of thousands of miles for short trips. So needless to say, today's find was an unexpected surprise. I'm actually flying for business, but I just couldn't see charging my client the $1,400 fare that Air Canada wanted for a regular ticket on a route that usually costs me $700. So, like you say, not time to give up quite yet. Well, Peter, it's interesting that you ended up using your own points for a business trip. Actually, I did something similar on my flight to and from London. Normally, I would book business class to have a chance at a decent night's sleep, especially with a big meeting the next morning. However, since my London client is a nonprofit that focuses on improving child's lives in developing countries, my conscience sort of seized up at the $5,000 premium for business over economy. So instead, I bought a coach ticket on United and used a couple of my system-wide upgrades to move up to business. I got the sleep that I needed, but not at a cost to the charity. Like Peter said, you know, not time to give up on those programs just yet. You know, and as I was reclining that business class seat on my London flight, trying to get a bit of shut-eye, I, of course, pulled out my Bose noise-canceling headphones. And looking at them, I noticed a big worn patch on the right headphone. You know, it kind of pulled me up a little. I don't know why. I've had them for 5 years, and they get quite a bit of mileage. But when I landed at Heathrow, I gave my rolling bag a good sort of once-over as I pulled it down from the overhead bin. You know, I saw a gash here and some scuffs there and some ripped fabric. And you know, the retractable handle, you know, now it's become a little bit recalcitrant if pushed too hard. You know, 5 years in and my travel kit, my travel companions are starting to look, I don't know, a bit frayed around the edges. You know, I can't quite bring myself to trading them out just yet, these companions, but I don't know. I'm not sure they'll make it to the end of 2009. And finally, there's an observation I'd just like to check with all of you. Am I mistaken, or has there been a significant uptick in cab drivers asking for cash whenever presented with a credit card for a fare? I mean, it seems recently that every time I've needed to pay a cab fare with a card, the driver will politely, but pointedly, ask me if I can pay in cash. Now, this wasn't the case, say, I don't know, 6 months ago. So I've started asking drivers, you know, sort of why the pushback. Now, the most popular reason is credit card processing fees. Some drivers have told me that they're paying a 20% processing fee. I don't know. That seems awfully high. I don't know if that's the full drag of the cab company's dispatch split plus the processing fee, but I'll tell you, that's a big number. The runner-up reason, I hear, is timing. It just takes too long to get their money, especially if it's a Friday. Perhaps, I don't know, perhaps this one is more about cash flow management, especially back a couple of months ago when gas was $4 a gallon. You know, I pay the guy with a card on Friday, the driver doesn't get his money until Monday, and so he doesn't have gas money to drive his cab over the weekend. I don't know. You know, just wondering, have any of you guys heard any different reasons? If you have, let me know. And if you have any other sort of a question, a story, a comment, the voice of the traveler, thoughts on cab drivers, pass them along. The email address, comments, COMMENTS at travelcommons.com, or you can always post them on the website at travelcommons.com. First topic on today's Travel Commons podcast is packing a suit. Now, in prior episodes, we've talked about the geographic differences and business dress code. You know, on flights heading east from Chicago, I see a much higher percentage of suit wearers than when I head west. And on the ground, you know, come to think of it, I think Washington, D.C.'s subway, the Metro, has by far the most suit-wearing riders of any subway that I ride. However, no matter what direction I'm heading, I've been pretty good at avoiding wearing a suit. You know, I might have to wear the occasional tie, but for the most part, I'm wearing a blazer on my flight and packing a few pair of matching wool slacks in my rolling bag. Now, this is certainly different from, say, 20 years ago when everyone wore suits and you traveled with a hanging suit bag. No wheels, you slung it over your shoulder and fought for space in the front closet of the plane to hang up your bag on boarding. Well, there you go. There's always been an advantage to pre-boarding, and there's always been a scuffle for limited baggage space. The hanging bags were also a pain if you wanted to carry anything other than suits and dress shirts. I mean, there was no elegant way to carry a pair of gym shoes in a hanging bag. You ended up with heavy lumps at either the top or the bottom of your bag, or sometimes both. A couple of months ago, I saw a guy I used to work with walking through O'Hare looked exactly like he did 15 years ago. Blue suit, white shirt, red tie, hanging bag slung over one shoulder, computer bag over the other. I looked at myself, black blazer, olive wool slacks, white shirt, no tie, rolling bag with my computer bag on top. I may not look as snappy as that guy, but I'm sure my back will hold out longer than his. So I absolutely panicked about a month and a half ago when I found out that my new client in Philadelphia is business formal, full suits and ties all the time. I don't know, I couldn't go back 15 years. I couldn't revert to being that guy I saw in O'Hare. I had to keep my rolling bag. Now, I wouldn't be keeping a regular enough schedule in Philadelphia that would allow me to leave my suits there, say at the hotel or at a local cleaner, which meant I needed to learn how to fold a suit. Now, this is not an easy thing. Folding wool slacks in a 22-inch roller is easy. Fold them in thirds, putting something in each fold, say an undershirt, your gym shorts, to keep the wrinkles at bay. A suit coat, though, isn't so easy. It's oddly shaped, not the simple long rectangle of a pair of pants. It has arms that flop around, and the shoulders might have some padding. It's just awkward. So searching the internet, though, there seems to be a consensus around two different ways of folding a suit. One approach is to turn the jacket inside out and then fold it in half. Now, some folks will then add an additional level of difficulty by placing one shoulder of the jacket into the other. The second approach, now, I can't figure out exactly how they're doing it, but it seems like some sort of suit coat origami. You lay the jacket flat, bend the sleeves at a 90-degree angle, then fold the jacket at the waist over suit pants. I tried this a couple of times and ended up, I don't know, what looked like a pinstripe towel animal. So I just ended up with my own simple method. I fold the jacket in half along the back seam, then accordion fold it in thirds, kind of like what I do with my pants, putting clothes in the folds. Box shirts from the cleaners work really the best. Most importantly, though, I pack light. I'll tell you, sitting on the top of the cover of your suitcase so you can zip it closed is a clear sign that you're going to end up with a wrinkled mess no matter which way you're packed. The best solution, though, I tell you, I got to be more careful in picking my clients. The second topic on today's Travel Commons podcast is that age-old question, why travel when you can video conference? Now, I'll tell you, when I Twittered or tweeted, I don't know, pick your own Web 2.0 verb, about traveling to London for a two-hour meeting, I'll tell you the at replies that I got back were, they weren't unexpected. Somebody with the handle Simon0117 asked, you know, in today's economic perspective, what about this meeting requires your physical presence instead of video or web conferencing? And Rich Frazier, a longtime Travel Commons listener, asked in a similar vein, haven't they heard of WebEx or GoToMeeting? Or are you more important than you've ever let on? Well, I'll tell you, Rich, I'm not even as important as I've let on, so that's not the answer. And I'll tell you, if in this specific situation with this client, prior to this meeting, we'd actually done all our meetings and review checkpoints via teleconference. I emailed a deck to everyone, and we did a low bandwidth page flip with participants spread out across the world, the U.S., the U.K., Kenya, Thailand. But this was the final meeting, and we were delivering some tough messages. I don't know, call me old school, but bad news is best delivered personally, face-to-face. Video conferencing or WebEx, just they don't get it done. And I'll tell you, God only knows that there have been times I would have loved to hide behind technology. During the dot-com bust, I had to close down our firm's Toronto office, and it was an office full of people that I had personally hired and worked very closely with. It would have been a lot easier to do exit interviews via teleconference, but I just couldn't do it. Not to them. So instead, I sat in an office all day long doing back-to-back 20-minute exit interviews with each person. I think that being there showed them, I don't know, more respect than a video conference would have, that they were worth me inconveniencing myself by flying to Toronto. Now, my meeting in London wasn't near as traumatic, but we were doing some truth-telling, and I needed to be able to read the expressions of the people receiving the news. And video conferencing just doesn't have that fidelity, at least not yet. Gartner released their annual Hype Cycle for Emerging Technologies report back in the fall, I think about August timeframe. And in it, they cited video telepresence, their term for, I don't know, some sort of high-def IMAX-like video conferencing setup that supports virtual meetings. And they said that this was on the brink of widespread adoption. Now, according to Gartner, video telepresence setup use, according to them, broadcast quality cameras and typically a set of three 50-inch plasma screens in specially designed rooms. Sounds like a, you know, if you can't do a video conference, that's a great place to catch a football game. Anyhow, Gartner continues, a telepresence room is usually limited to 6 users sitting along one side of a conference table with 2 seats facing each screen. A lifelike effect is achieved by placing cameras behind the screens, so live participants are shown staring directly into the eyes of the remote person. They predict, Gartner predicts that utilization of these high-end telepresence rooms will be much higher than traditional video conferencing rooms. I guess they, I don't know if they're counting, you know, sort of that that off-cycle usage for watching Monday Night Football. Anyhow, it's interesting, and it's an interesting concept, but I don't know. Unless these units come with automated arms that can transmit a pat on the back, I think I'm still going to occasionally have a good need and a good reason to do some really stupid travel.
Snow and mistletoe and presents under the tree.
And the last topic on today's Travel Commons podcast, and it's been a while since we've actually gone to 3 topics on a Travel Commons podcast. Anyhow, the last topic today, outsmarting winter flight delays. I'll tell you, it's winter, in case the solstice slipped by without you noticing, or in case you haven't flown through, I don't know, the upper 2/3 of the country over the past 3 to 4 weeks. I'll tell you, it seems like a tough December. I mean, a lot colder and a lot snowier a lot earlier this year. I mean, when Portland and Seattle are getting iced in and, you know, we haven't even hit Christmas yet, that's saying a lot. Although, I don't know, you know, the other thing is it could be, you know, I'm feeling the brunt of it maybe because I'm just feeling a little bit unlucky, landing in a blizzard in Denver earlier this month, trying to return, you know, into a blizzard in Chicago last Friday. You know, usually it's not a question of are you going to be delayed, but by how much, or worse, are you going to get canceled? At different times, Travel Common listeners Alan Marco and Mika Prakala, and Mika, I continue to apologize for butchering your last name. Alan and Mika have pointed me at different times to flightstats.com, and I'll tell you, it's a pretty rich site. Yeah, I mean, you can see pictures of, you know, of airport delays set up on a U.S. map. You can sign up for flight alerts for your specific flights. You can see a lot of stuff on it. But for winter travel, I like to use the Track Flight Status by Route travel tool. So looking, say, you know, last Friday, looking at all the flights from Philadelphia to O'Hare, and this is when it was raining in Philadelphia and snowing in Chicago, I could tell by about lunchtime that things were going to work out for me. United, American, and US Air had all canceled their first flights out, but after that, things were sort of stable until the afternoon rush. United had canceled the flight before mine and after mine, which you would think would make me nervous, but actually the complete opposite. I knew that my flight was going to be packed, but that it was going to have to fly. So, and as it turned out, my flight landed about an hour late. Again, not bad given the really lousy weather at both ends. You know, and I'll tell you, because you can look back one day back, you know, at yesterday's flight history, it gives you the opportunity to sort of revel in that guilty pleasure that we call electronic schadenfreude back in episode number 67. If I jumped on that earlier flight, did I really make it home any sooner? Now, I wish their mobile version was a bit richer. You have to click through, say if you're looking at it on your iPhone, you have to click through to get to information that's displayed nicely all on one page in the full browser version. And the browser version, I wish it wasn't quite so weighed down with flash ads, but these are minor quibbles. I'll tell you, Flight Stats is definitely staying in my travel toolkit. We'll be right back. Okay, that's it. That's the end of Travel Commons Podcast number 70. I hope you all enjoyed this podcast, and I hope you decide to stay subscribed. Better yet, I hope you decide to tell someone that's not subscribed that they ought to subscribe to it. Hey, the Christmas bridge music is from the PodSafe Music Network, music.podshow.com, Greensleeves by Tequila Mockingbirds, Please Come Home for Christmas by Oppenheimer, Merry Christmas Baby by Calvin Owens, and from Katie Mack, I'll Be Home for Christmas. As always, you'll find these links in the show notes. And remember, if you have a story, thought, comment, gripe, moans and groans, cries of anguish, the voice of the traveler, send them along, text or MP3 file to comments, COMMENTS at travelcommons.com, or post them on our website at travelcommons.com. Thanks to everyone who's taken the time to send in emails or post comments on the website. So getting this out right before Christmas, like I said, I'm home for the next 2 weeks. I post this to the website and I immediately dive into cooking the big Christmas dinner, 7-rib standing rib roast, full English, Yorkshire pudding popovers, the whole routine. So I'll tell you what, I got to wrap this thing up. I got to edit it. I got to upload it so I can put my apron on and get to work. I hope you, all of you, have a great holiday season for those of you celebrating. I hope you have a very, very happy Christmas, and for everyone, a great new year. And as always, thanks for stopping by the Travel Commons. Take care, travel safe. Until we talk again, I'll see you soon. Bye now.
Life is hell, strange bed in a lonely motel. But one thing needs my mind, the warm woman that I left behind. From California to Carolina, she calls me up and there's nothing finer. And when the tears start falling down,